Hi, and welcome to Lowdown with me, Nick Cohen. Today I'm joined by Will Hutton, one of the most famous and productive progressive intellectuals in the UK. He's written so many books, it's hard to keep up with them. Most famously, The State We're In, which came out just before the Labour landslide of 1997. He was editor of The Observer, and I'm sure when history remembers him and his obituaries and his very tombstone were recalled, his finest hour there was when he hired me as a columnist. He is now the author of This Time, No Mistakes, How to Remake Britain, which is coming out just before what looks like it could be another Labour landslide. Will, welcome to the Lowdown.
Thank you for inviting me.
It's my pleasure. And Will, in your book, you, I guess, want to talk about, I think the best way to get this into listeners' minds about the scale of the trouble the country faces and Labour will face when it takes power is at the end of a pretty depressing, at times, tour of the state of the nation, you say all the lights are flashing red. What do you mean by that? How would you describe the crisis in British society?
Well, first of all, the famous economist Paul Krugman said, productivity is not everything, but in the long run, it is everything. And productivity in Britain over the last 15 years has been growing at 0.4% per annum. Capital stock has been growing at 0.2% per annum. That's per worker. And that's led to, you know, a calamitous decline in real wages below what they would otherwise have been, and the squeeze on living standards. So that's one thing. As a national economy, we simply don't invest in ourselves sufficiently. And that has a cascade effect on British society. Everyone has their own kind of favorite examples. I mean, I think that, you know, at the moment, you know, really worried about an epidemic of shoplifting and pickpocketing and kind of and street crime. But it's impossible to kind of discuss that without also discussing the fact that, you know, over 4 million kids are living in households that are poor. And, you know, you just can't, you know, disentangle these things. We have the shortest 5-year-olds in Europe. That's a story of, I think, malnutrition. And its educational levels are stagnating for secondary education. Then there's a kind of the crisis in our political system, which I think that I'm sure we'll talk about. I mean, ethics in government, I mean, actually just doing good and consistent government, getting government devolved to where it needs to be. Local government, we have the biggest local authority in Europe, Birmingham, has just gone bust. It's administered by commissioners. Over the next couple of years, it's estimated that 1 in 5 English local governments will go bust. And I, you know, I've just selected, I'm sure your listeners will have others that identify that I could have mentioned.
Well, I mean, the interesting thing, Will, or the scandalous thing is, it's very hard to look at any corner of a public square and not find that it's derelict now. I mean, you were talking about, you know, for shoplifting, 4 million kids in poverty. You know, the police and criminal justice system, which is meant to protect shop owners, is derelict. They complain, they call, no one comes. Well, how do you explain what's happened? Do you say, look, the crash of 2008 disproportionately hit this country because we were so dependent on financial services? Or do you blame the long Tory rule that pretty much followed?
My kind of big thought, and I'm going to answer your question directly after I've given my big thought. My big thought is that actually, broadly speaking, the post-war settlement ran into trouble in the 70s. And for 45 years since Mrs. Thatcher's election, essentially, policymakers have been putting individualism, kind of at the heart of the economic, social, and moral universe, and playing down the we. And a big part of my book is trying to, This Time, No Mistakes, is to try and argue that actually there is a we, and that actually society matters, and that requires pro-social policies. And actually capitalism itself requires a strong society to have firm foundations, and it itself has social obligations. It itself needs to take a more pro-social stance. So, you know, ignoring those maxims has led to a series of disasters, one on another, which have their long shadows. I mean, it began in the 80s with monetarism and the deindustrialization and the launch of financial deregulation with the Big Bang. That led directly to the Great Crash, a great financial crash. It was worse in Britain than elsewhere. We didn't have to have austerity in quite the kind of manner it was conducted, in which all the kind of burden of deficit reduction was taken by cuts in public spending, unbelievable cuts in public spending. Then there's Brexit, which had its origins in the same kind of delusional kind of notion that capitalism and markets are self-organizing and the less state and the less European state, the better. And lastly, the Liz Truss budget. And you put all that together and you have what we have, Nick.
As you say, as you write, Will, you can tell the crisis by the chaos in politics. We've gone from Labour under Corbyn in 2019, just collapsing, worst defeat since the 30s. And in some ways, it looks, at least in 1935, Labour was on the up. Labour seems to be on the down. It seemed to be a disaster. Boris Johnson seemed to have a decade of rule. It's all collapsed. But it's sort of collapsed, or perhaps I'm wrong here, Will, but it's collapsed for rather... for reasons which don't really tell you much about the future of the country. Perhaps I'm wrong on this. If Boris Johnson just breaks the basic moral code of the British, which still exists. You don't have one law for the powerful and another for everyone else. He's gone. And Liz Truss, I mean, Conservatives now try to paint her as sort of this mad accident, as if she arrived from outer space. You've got those two, and that's just killed the Conservative Party. Everyone admits that. But it doesn't seem to give Labour... Or does Labour have a sort of platform of a new consensus it can work with to rebuild the country? Or is this almost just getting in because, well, they're not the Tories and we'll just give them a try?
There is fantastic pessimism about the UK at the moment. I mean, you can do opinion polls where, you know, you see them. What's it? Three quarters of respondents say that, you know, they've got no confidence in politics or in the future. And there is a tiredness with being misgoverned by the Conservative Party, but actually in no particular enthusiasm for Labour, but a sense that actually Keir Starmer may be uncharismatic and maybe rather limited, but he's a decent guy and plainly trying to move his party in the right direction. And I think he's given kind of grudging tick for that, hence the lead in the opinion polls. But you're right. I mean, it's only 2 years ago that Labour were behind in the polls. Politics doesn't cut through to most people's lives. But the resignation of Boris Johnson and then the resignation of Liz Truss certainly did. And the Liz Truss budget, which, you know, doubled mortgage rates in the space of 3 months. My view about the Labour Party and the Labour leadership at the moment is that the glass is half full rather than half empty. I mean, it's very easy to tell a story of how, you know, given the depth of the problems that, you know, I described at the beginning and I didn't even touch, I could have gone on for another, you know, 10 or 20 minutes on it.
Oh, God, yeah.
But the five missions that Labour have set themselves, you know, highest growth in the G7, the big effort to decarbonize the economy by 2030, you know, national health service back on its feet, opportunity and education are all, and streets safer, actually are, you know, if this could be pulled off, would be transformative, actually. And I think there's, in all those areas, there's some signs that they're moving, sometimes baby steps and sometimes stronger steps. And I do think their new agenda for work is an important statement about kind of trying to create a kind of better work environments for the bulk of working people.
You have been listening to Lowdown with me, Nick Cohen. Our guest this week is Will Hutton. Perhaps you could extrapolate on that a bit, because perhaps some listeners won't know what this is.
Anglo-Rain
is a gender, is it?
Yeah, yeah. This is essentially, there are 33 million people in the working population. And, you know, only about just over 40% of them have stable, tenured employment that comes with the full panoply of employment rights and entitlements, sickness pay, holiday leave, and all the rest of it. The rest of the working population are living in very kind of working very insecure working environments. And at the bottom, I mean, a goodly number, 0-hour contracts are the most extreme form of it, but kind of forms of employment where actually you can be sacked at will with only days' notice. And indeed, I mean, there's as I say in the book, I mean, there's more than 2 million people who don't get a payslip. Others, again, who have kind of absolutely kind of no contract of employment. So, you know, it's kind of, and the Labour idea is to say, well, no, we think that there should be entitlements to as much as possible within reason on day one of an employment contract. So you shouldn't be sackable at will. You should have entitlements to kind of holiday entitlement, sickness pay, and all the rest of it.
It's quite a strong answer to those people who say, oh, Starmer's guest Tory light, or, you know, red Tory, or whatever you want to put it. What strikes me about them is, and they don't get much credit for this at all, neither left doesn't want Sayers at all, is that they're not like Blair in 1996, 1997. For instance, Blair in 1996, or the Blair of 1996, would, if the Tories had come up with deporting people to Rwanda, would have just said, we've got to go along with it. Yeah. But Labour is saying, no, this is a cruel and insane idea, and we want no part of it. They are, in a way, more radical than people give them credit for.
It's in the public domain. I mean, I launched the book 10 days ago, the beginning of middle of April, April the 15th. Keir Starmer surprised me by saying he was willing to come along and speak at the launch. And he and you know, we had a minute or two, and he came on as a surprise guest. Actually, he couldn't stay long. He had the Rwanda stuff. He had to go back for that.
Right.
But two things surprised me. Well, three things surprised me, actually. First thing that surprised me was that an audience of 600-700 people at the Union Chapel in North London, first of all, taken aback, then started clapping, and then, to my amazement, started cheering. I didn't know he was going to. I mean, it was just spontaneous, you know. And he then spoke. That's the first thing I was surprised about. The second thing I was really taken aback by was he said the book was brilliant and warmly, and said everyone should read it. And, you know, I mean, you read the book. I mean, it's not exactly, it's not tame. And
no, it's not. No, I mean, it's not a book for a party that's insecure. And you know, Labour has every right to be insecure, Will. The Corbyn years absolutely traumatised.
I know.
You know, as you're saying, 2 years ago, they couldn't even win a seat in Hartlepool. Now they're heading to a landslide. And all of a sudden, you know, it all comes quickly. But it's not a book for a party that's insecure. And so, you know, Starmer doesn't seem insecure. And it is a radical book.
The leader of the Labour Party said, read this book, it's brilliant. And then I said to him, look, here, this is the third thing. I said, there's one chapter called Spreading the Muck to Fill the Gaps. And it's lifted from Francis Bacon, the English philosopher, who wrote, you know, in 1625, wealth is like muck, best if it's spread around. So I put that quote to him. And I said, how do you react to that quote? You don't have to have any electoral hostages to fortune. And he just says, completely spontaneously, their party is about redistribution and always will be. If they take office, I think they will launch a big program of public borrowing to crowd in private investment. I think they will reshape the savings and financial landscape to permit more companies to get the wherewithal they need to kind of follow through on taking advantage of the opportunities thrown up by that big surge in public investment. I think they will reshape the workplace in the manner in which I've described. They will find the money to improve public services. And they will, I think, get closer to and reassociate with the European Union. I mean, I would want more than that.
Well, I mean, one reason why, let's be optimistic for a bit, why we could be in for a long period of Labour rule is the bar is so low now. I'm trying to find historical parallels, so we always grasp at those to sort of give us some bearings. This is a lot like 1997, because in 1997, the Tories, however badly they were losing, could go to their clubs, pour themselves a glass of port and say, yeah, but the Thatcher right settlement's holding. Blair is keeping the Thatcher right settlement. So in the long run, we've won. They could say that. I don't see what the hell a Tory can say in 2024. I don't see how they can be proud of anything they've done, anything that they're just leaving a wrecked, depressed, not even country so depressed it can barely be angry at times. So the bar is so low. So if Labour can just start improving a bit, I'm sure they can have 10 years in power, Will.
I'm hoping. I do think in a democracy you need a viable centre-right that isn't mad, but we haven't got it. It's very important that Labour do have a sustained period in office, not least to kind of force the Conservative Party or whoever emerges as the champion of the right in Britain to be kind of not actually to do murderously wrong things. So, I mean, I'm hoping that Labour do have that period in office. And I hope, by the way, that they start to kind of, rather like the post-war settlement became Churchill couldn't govern in 1951, nor Eden or Macmillan following him, without accepting Labour's post-war settlement, high marginal rates of tax, the NHS, a big, big social housing programme, had to do it all. And we want a Labour government to be as successful as that, but through the act of being successful, to kind of demonstrate there's a paradigm. I call it the We Society paradigm. You call it the social democratic paradigm, which actually you just have to accept it because that's what folk want in their day-to-day lives, and they're going to vote for it in elections. And so if you want to succeed Labour, you've got to accept that settlement.
So many people listening, I'm sure, would say this. So look, okay, we need more wealth. We need to grow the economy. We need to be a rich society to have this settlement. Economically, a no-brainer would be to join the EU. But politically, it seems impossible to even talk about this at the moment.
It's extraordinary how something as damaging as leaving the European Union is not openly talked about or confronted. We kind of know why. I mean, Labour think it's toxic in some of the seats they're hoping to win in the Midlands and the north of England. And Professor Nick Crafts is one of our, he died actually sadly in the autumn, but he's a fantastic economic historian and nobody doubts his numbers. And he calculated that the impacts of EU membership had lifted British gross domestic product by 10%, more than otherwise have been. Trade effects, investment effects, being part of European supply chain effects. We've lost half of that in just the 4 years since 2000 and, January 2020, when we formally left the European Union. And we're going to lose the rest of it in the next few years. And in the language of economists, it's a kind of headwind in which it's almost impossible to make much progress. I mean, trend growth in the British economy is 1 to 1.5% if you're lucky.
But you see, Will, if you're going to turn that around, if this period is going to be like 1945, bringing a social democratic settlement, the 1980s, bringing a Thatcherite neoliberal settlement that is accepted. I mean, surely you're going to need political leaders with a bit of courage, really, who just say that. I mean, I cannot imagine any Labour politician even standing up and saying what you've just said and saying, but that's the price we're paying for leave Brexit. But I just want you all to know that that is the price we are paying.
Well,
I'm being naive, and perhaps if you follow that advice, you lose an election. But I just don't see.
No, well,
unless you're brave, how it goes, you know.
Again, it's the hourglass being half full, half empty. I mean, Rachel Reeves back in March, she gave this big lecture in the city in which she did. Yeah. It's cost. She didn't use the figure 5%. She used the figure 4%. But she did actually stand in front of an audience and say just what I've said.
Oh, fair enough.
But I mean, and also they're quite keen. I mean, David Lammy, in a paper he produced last week, said, we want a big, baggy defence pact with the European Union. Mm. We want joint procurement of weapon systems. We want measures on energy resilience. We want measures on cybersecurity. We want measures on data protection. We want to make sure that kind of food supplies are secure. I mean, and when you add it all up, energy, food, defence procurement, data, you're talking 10 to 15% of GDP, where actually in all those sectors, to make the defence pact work, you'd have to align with European regulations. Mm. And that part of the economy, rather like Northern Ireland, would actually be in the single market. And then all you've got to, if you follow through and you negotiate the trade and cooperation agreements, it's kinder to financial services, creative industries, and the service sector more generally. When I look at, even in the Brexit zone terms, here we are, we're the second biggest exporter of services in the world. And we do a trade deal with the European Union that Boris Johnson boasts about being oven ready, which excluded services and was all about goods, where we have an enormous trade deficit with the Europeans. Shooting yourself in the foot doesn't capture how stupid it was.
Dear stupidity.
I mean, you're just breathtaking. I mean, Lord David Frost is the author of one of the worst trade deals that any nation state's ever struck in history.
You have been listening to Lowdown with me, Nick Cohen. Our guest this week is Will Hutton. Here's what's interesting, Will. The Tories themselves seem to accept that. They don't talk about Brexit anymore. It's gone from being what was going to guarantee them becoming a sort of hegemonic national party with working class votes and Surrey stockbrokers all going together. So they don't even talk about it anymore.
I know.
I'm sure in their hearts, some of them, must be willing to say this is all just a terrible mistake. I mean, some of them who actually campaigned for Brexit.
There's a curious, I think you're right. And I think there's a very interesting kind of social political geography opened up on the British right, which is, I mean, a lot of people who are natural conservatives are in the city, the big four accountancy firms, the magic circle law firms, kind of financial services more generally, tops of British companies. But they are almost to, a man and a woman aware that actually Brexit's been a disaster. The London stock market has gone from number 3 to number 9 in the world. The deal flow has dried up. Banks are leaving London. Goldman Sachs have sent their kind of head of operations and is going to move to Paris, I think, to run Goldman Sachs. Mm-hmm. Shell are saying that we're going to have a listing in New York. We're considering a listing in New York rather than London. And, they all say they'll be telling their conservative MPs and when they dine with them and lunch with them what a disaster it is. And the MPs can't fail to know that, but they don't choose to say so, because to get a nomination in a constituency association of the Tory party, kind of at the moment, many of whose members in key constituencies are former members of the Brexit party, have to talk this kind of Europhobic language. And so anything European is kind of de facto and definitionally bad. And if the European Court of Human Rights challenges the Rwanda flights, the right-wing press and an element of the Tory party will start foaming at the mouth, asking, you know, we must leave the European Court of Human Rights. This kind of Europhobia is kind of in the tabloids, the right-wing tabloids, and in part of the parliamentary party. Meanwhile, the heartlands of Tory England that are active in the workplace are kind of saying, this is a disaster. And the over 65s, who are 2-1 Tory and who kind of come out to vote at general elections, bought the kind of line that Mrs. Thatcher was a god. It's, and
from Mark. Yeah, I know, but it's an extraordinary thing that's happened to the Tories, though, Will, isn't it? Because they've gone from being the party of business, the party of the city, the party for if you were in work and aspirational and wanted to make money in the city or everywhere else, to being party of anti-business, anti-city, and for pensioners who don't get up in the morning to go to work.
No, I know. And of course, they know that too. The Tory party isn't bereft of thinkers. They've been in power, twice as much as Labour, you know, over the last kind of, since the war and going right back to 1885, actually, okay, the last 139 years, Tories have governed, you know, many more years than the opposition parties. They know the value of holding power in the British system, where it's not just about being a lawmaker, it's about who chairs what public institution. They know very well, you know, how the power of patronage, that the control of the British state gives you. But, I mean, they can feel it slipping through their fingers. I don't know what you think, Nick, but I'm a little bit concerned that actually, you know, the flights take off, the Rwanda flights take off in July, and then there's a challenge from the European Court of Human Rights. So, you know, Sunak...
And they fight their election against foreign judges.
Who governs Britain, yeah.
Yeah, maybe they will. To be perfectly honest, Will, and God knows I can't, you know, I have no clue. I just think they're done. I think they're absolutely finished. They will do whatever they can. You can see them doing it now with unaffordable tax cuts and all the rest of it. They will do that. I just think they're bust. I think they're absolutely bust. Will, seriously.
Vernacular on your podcast, Wick.
Seriously, Will. You're a Conservative member. You go out knocking on doors in, you know, say November. What the bloody hell are you going to say to people about why the Conservatives deserve another term? What on earth are you going to say?
I know. But, you know, there's a powerful press. There's atavist instincts. There's all the evidence that, you know, a lot of voters only make their mind in the kind of day polling and all that stuff. I mean, I'm with you. I think the country has made up its collective mind. It wants a change of government. And I actually think that what's happening on the right, with the rise of reform and the European Court of Human Rights, actually symbolises the division. I mean, are you going to play that populist card, or
leave aside the fact we can't leave. Because the Belfast Agreement is actually written into it.
Leaving aside, I know.
But the Americans would go mad. And I've had government ministers tell me that American security people have said you will not believe what will happen to you if you do this, to Conservative ministers and Conservative security people. Unfortunately, as we saw in the Brexit debate, these facts, you know, facts don't get out about it. You know, it all just becomes horse race politics. But seriously, I know being on the left is to accustom yourself to a lifetime defeat, but do you really think you're going to wake up the day after the next general election and think, oh my God, the Tories are still in power?
You know, I spent 18 months writing a book where I tried to set out a kind of a philosophy for the liberal left that I felt could do two things, kind of bind the liberal left together, this kind of fusing what I call an ethical socialism and progressive liberalism, and actually ends up with kind of statements and politics and policies that I think appeal to the majority of British. And I did it because I feel so passionately that actually that they must lose office and stay out of office for a long period. They have kind of forfeited the right to govern. And a lot of thinking Tories think that too, by the way. I mean, I don't think there's the fact that close to 100 Tory MPs are not standing at the next election.
Well, that's very telling, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very telling, you know.
Will, thank you so much for coming on. That's been absolutely terrific. Will, your book is called?
This Time, No Mistakes, How to Remake Britain.
Available in all good bookshops, I hope?
Available in all good bookshops. In fact,
and very reasonably priced, I'm sure. Will, thank you. thanks so much for coming on. That's been absolutely terrific.
And thank you, Nick, for the invitation and your good questions. Thank you.
This is Nick Cohen. I'm just going to wrap up by saying, if you like this podcast, could you please give it a good rating or a nice review? That always helps. Save it or subscribe to it so you can get future episodes. There's many more interesting interviews coming. While you do that, all it remains for me to say is you've been listening to The Lowdown. My name's Nick Cohen. Thank you and goodbye.